Welcome back to Current State. We are, by the way, in the home stretch of planning for our next live program on the road. We're taking the show on the road all the way to downtown East Lansing, the East Lansing Folk Festival, which we're excited about. We'll be doing the program live at 6 p.m. a week from tomorrow night and talking to musicians and participating folk artists and craftspeople and clawhammer banjo prodigies and scrimshaw zealots, all manner of interesting people here a week from tomorrow night at the East Lansing Folk Festival. We are looking forward to that. We are glad to have you along here today. At the top of the program, we've got a primary election coming up next Tuesday. Lansing residents go to the polls to vote in their next primary election. Four incumbents on the city council are facing challengers, as well as Mayor Virge Bernero. Now, in these final days leading up to the Lansing primary, Current State takes a look at the key races from the voters' perspective. We're starting with the race for Lansing's second ward city council seat. We'll move to the fourth ward race here in just a few minutes. In the second, incumbent Tina Houghton is facing challenger Charles Hoffmeyer. Keep in mind, this race actually won't appear on next week's ballot. Instead, both of these candidates will advance automatically to the general election in November, since there are a total of just two. I'm joined now by a couple members of a neighborhood association in Tina Houghton's second ward. Brett Stockhill is the vice president of the Forest View Neighborhood Association. Hi, Brett.
Hello.
And Jan Culp is a past president of the association. Jan joins us by phone. Welcome, Jan.
Good morning, but I am the current president.
Current president, right. I beg your pardon.
That's okay.
We'll correct that. Thank you. Brett Stockhill, tell us how long you've been involved in your particular neighborhood association.
Probably about 18 years since I've lived in the neighborhood. So I wound up showing up at one of the meetings and getting into a discussion, and they basically elected me to participate.
And they did not let you leave. It's basically what it boils down to. That often happens. Jan, what about you?
Well, I've lived here for 48 years, and we didn't have an organization at the time, but Lynn Stutman lived in the neighborhood then.
Ah, yes.
And if anything came up, he would call a meeting and everyone would go. Of course, the neighborhood has grown a lot since then, but we are one of the oldest neighborhood organizations in the city.
Brett, give us a handle on the second for folks who are not familiar with it. Where is it? Who lives there? What tend to be their concerns?
The boundaries generally are Mount Hope down to Jolly Road, from 127 over to Sycamore Creek. So we have quite a large area, but it's not all habitable because we have both cemeteries. We have Fenner in Park in there, and we have Hawk Island Park in there. So with a lot of real estate taken up that way. Most of the people, it's all a mix of single-family homes, duplexes. We have a couple of apartment complexes in there. Technically, the apartments, Trapper Cove and Cherry Hill over off of Dunkel. But most of those don't, the college kids and stuff, don't participate. So,
Jan, is there anything you'd add to that?
Well, we did an inventory of our area last year, and it amazed even us who have lived here all that is contained within our neighborhood. And we have a school, we have Forest View, we have Beekman Center, and it's a very diverse neighborhood, but I can testify it's a great place to live.
What's been your level of interaction with your city council members in the past, Brett?
I'd say they show up at pretty much every meeting. Sandy Allen, who recently passed away, was just a wonderful person. She paid attention and tried to get to everything. And Tina Houghton shows up at most of the meetings. So in general, it's been pretty much a very neighborhood one-on-one conversation with her.
Jan Culp, have there been specific projects or complaints or requests that you've taken to Tina Houghton?
Well, I guess most recently is the fireworks situation.
Okay.
And everybody has experienced some of that. And I thought the council responded well to people's complaints on that.
What about Tina in particular, Tina Houghton?
Well, I definitely called her, and this was even it was a couple weeks before the 4th, and left a message for her. And we had, it was a little over a year ago, we had a problem with students from Forest View jumping fences and being somewhat destructive to some of the neighbors' property up there. And we all worked together on that and had a great outcome of that. And so it's really wonderful when you see a group of people come together. We all want the best for our neighborhoods, and when you've got that goal and work together, you can accomplish that.
Brett, anything you'd add to that?
I think she covered quite a bit. Thank you for bringing up the vandalist students. I was thinking that as well. Emily Hall, the new principal over at Forest View, she came to our meetings, and she's been coming since. So the school is involved. We had talked to Tina Houghton on that at the meeting, and she talked to the police, and the police were kind of not involved at that point. So it wound up getting everybody involved in the situation and pretty much resolved itself. So once everybody got involved, so that was a really good episode.
Let's get a little bit deeper into the issues as they might pertain to the election here. We spoke with your councilperson, Tina Houghton, earlier this week about a lot of topics. One of them was crime. Let's listen to a bit of that.
Neighborhood watches are so important to our neighborhoods and to our city to make sure that neighbors look out for each other. Police officers obviously are in the neighborhoods. They're running around doing their job. But to have citizens actively out and about is probably the best thing that our city can have.
Jan Culp, how much of an issue is crime in the second ward?
Well, in our particular area, we have a low crime rate, and we're kind of known for that. But as Tina said, we look out for each other. I got a call a couple days ago that my neighbor's car had been broken into during the night in their driveway. And so I got with Brett. He put it out on an email to the people in our organization. The people next door they're college students, and they are a part of the organization. They've just moved in. So I went over there and talk to them, let them know that there was a problem, so keep an eye on your cars. So anyway, we just try to spread the word, and another thing organizations are good for is when you've got a problem. We don't have a lot of problems here, but when you do, you've got a place to take it. And Tina has been very responsive to that.
Brett, Tina Houghton is considered a member of the mayor's voting bloc on the council. Is that a factor in your decision-making process?
I consider it a low priority. She pays attention to our neighborhood organization. She comes, she talks about the issues, she talks about what's going on the council. She does listen to us, but in some fashion, some of the bigger issues within the city, if I think she's doing the right thing, because she's not going to agree with me on 100% of my philosophy, so it would play a little bit of a part in that.
Generally, do you assess her performance as good? Do you consider Tina Houghton an effective city councilor, or are you looking at Mr. Hoffmeyer here?
I consider Tina a prime candidate for me. So I am going to consider both candidates right now. Tina Houghton, I don't have anything really too negative to say.
What about you, Jan?
I feel like Tina was, as Brett said, Sandy Allen was great when she was here, and we hated to see her go, but feel that Tina has stepped in and stepped up, and I wouldn't want to change that.
Okay. Well, we want to thank both of you for joining us here today. I beg your pardon. You're Brett Stockhill. You're Vice President of the Forest View Neighborhood Association. Jan Culp, thanks to you as well. You're President of that association. We appreciate your time a lot.
Thank you.
Yep. I would like to add one thing and offer Mr. Hoffman to come to our council meeting before the next elections, and we always welcome all candidates to come.
Very good. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Let's move north and west now to Lansing's 4th Ward, which includes downtown, the west side, and parts of Old Town. There, incumbent Jessica Yorko faces off next Tuesday against three challengers. They are Chong Anakan Fora, who works for the liberal political advocacy group Progress Michigan, Lansing attorney Bert Carrier Jr., and Larry Hutchinson, a 40-year-old stay-at-home father. The top two vote-getters next Tuesday will face off in November's general election. Here to talk about what's going on in the 4th Ward and to assess Councilmember Jessica Yorko's performance is Rena Risper. She's the president of the Walnut Neighborhood Association. Welcome, Rena. And Paul Johns is president of the Moores Park Neighborhood Association. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
What are voters talking about in the 4th Ward, Paul?
Well, you know, I think more than anything what voters want is an opportunity to get to meet and have face time with each of the candidates. And heading towards the primary, I think they just want to know who to select to be on the ballot.
Do you feel like you've got two good choices here?
Oh, yeah, we do, definitely.
Do you have four good choices? I guess that's my question. I'm still in the second ward here.
That's okay.
You got four people running.
Oh, absolutely, yep. And what's very important is that people get out and try to get an opportunity to talk to these people and find out what they're about. I have interest in each one of them and have been able to talk to each one of them. But it's very important that the voters get out and be able to ask the hard questions. And so they need to be accessible.
Now, you've got a record. Jessica Yorko's been serving on the council. Are you impressed enough? It sounds as if you are still interested in hearing what the challengers have to say. So
absolutely.
You have not ruled out not voting for the incumbent.
It's not time to rule anybody out at this point.
Okay. What do you think, Rena Risper? You're pretty plugged in. What do you think people are talking about in the 4th Ward? What issues rise to the top?
I think one of the foremost issues that rise to the top is availability of our city council, our current city council person, Jessica Yorko. There's been a lot of complaint about not being able to reach her and not having returned phone calls. And that's going to be an issue. And attendance in city council meetings is crucially important for her to be able to represent the 4th Ward adequately.
So it sounds like you're looking closely at a challenger?
We're looking very closely at a challenger.
Okay. Now, when you say we, you're a newspaper publisher.
No.
As well.
I
you're
say
talking
we
about yourself.
As my friends who live in the neighborhood with
okay.
me.
Okay. As a resident of the Walnut neighborhood.
As a resident who lives around other people in the 4th Ward.
Very good. We spoke with Jessica Yorko earlier this week. At one point, she commented on what she considers the city's unsustainable predicament involving declining revenues and population. Let's listen.
If people in the region want a strong core city, they need to live in that city. We can't continue to lose population. When we look at the percent of the residents in the region from 1940 to now who are residents of the city of Lansing, it has declined from having 40% of the population of the region in the city to under 20%. That's not sustainable.
Paul Johns, that is clearly a concern of your council representative and others. Is it a concern of yours?
Well, that's what happens, it seems. When someone gets angry, the first thing they say is, that's it, I'm moving, you know, and instead of coming to the root of the problem and coming up with a resolution, the only thing they have that they can really take is their tax dollars. And they know if they move out of the city, they're going to be able to, you know, take that with them. So, yeah, that's a concern. Obviously, we want the tax revenue. We want people to be in neighborhoods. We want them to feel like they're part of their neighborhood. And that they have a say.
Are you glad that that's a priority of Jessica Yorko's?
I would hope it would be a priority of anybody on city council that we have, you know, an increased population growth.
Rena, what about
and jobs?
I have an interesting perspective. We were speaking with the Westside Association about the possibility of having a police chief that actually lives in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And to have individuals who live in the city to protect the city, who know about, who have an idea about the crime going on in the city. And it would be interesting to find out what the response would be to that. I've heard that we can't make anyone live in the city. However, when we've had past mayors, it was a priority of the past mayor to, you know, say, I would love for you to live in the city. And they did live in the city. So you can, there's a thing about saying things and not really having any action behind what you're saying. So it would be really interesting to find out her take on that issue.
You don't know whether she would be in favor of that or not?
I have an idea, but it wasn't very clear, as most things that I'm hearing from her are not very clear.
Is that a would that be a question that you would want to ask the challengers as well, I assume?
Sure, it would be a question that I would love to ask the challengers. Would you be opposed to having individuals in the mayor's cabinet living in the city?
Paul, what do you think about that? Should that be mandatory, that high-ranking officials actually reside in the city of Lansing?
That would be, obviously, that would be the icing on the cake. You know, you're definitely, if you live in the mud that you're slinging, of course, you know. Yeah.
Rena pointed out that she feels Jessica Yorko has been too inaccessible and her attendance record hasn't been strong enough. Is that a problem for you?
Oh, no. I just, you know, to tell you the truth, whenever I've had an issue, I've been able to call city council, and not just Jessica Yorko. You know, I've had access to Kathy Dunbar. I've had access to Carol Wood. I've had access to Jessica Yorko, and I think it's equal share. They need to return their phone calls when people call. So I haven't experienced that personally.
Okay. Has the situation involving the Nya Wave structure been resolved satisfactorily in your view or not? That's in the fourth ward.
You know, that's been very, very interesting as well. I'm seeing that Jessica Yorko has indicated that she has been instrumental in moving that forward, which is not the case at all. Dale Schrader and I, for the last 2 months, have been working diligently with Bob Trezise of LEAP. And Bob Schrader and I, based on Mary Elaine's 17-page document, have hammered out a deal with LEAP. And it did not have anything at all to do with the influence of Jessica Yorko. And I find that sometimes, this is my first opportunity having an opportunity to reply to some of the things that I see. I just have to chuckle at times because it's only been the two of us, and we got it done in 2 months. I find that sometimes...
Which is the other person you're talking about?
Dale Schrader.
Dale Schrader, okay.
Dale Schrader, he's the one that helped with formulating what we were going to do as far as fixing the facade, and we got everything that we wanted, and we're in the process now of moving through that.
But Jessica Yorko was not involved enough in your view?
She wasn't involved at all. And I also have a document that she sent out in the beginning talking about how she was involved. And that was not the case. If anything, it was like, well, I would like to know still would like to know who is responsible for making sure that the terms of the SLU go forward.
Paul, what do you make of this? Have you paid close attention to the Nya Wave structure thing?
Well, it's not a structure in our neighborhood. So what we did as a neighborhood group, when it was brought to our attention, is we wrote a letter in support of Nya Wave continuing conversation, because I think at one point they just stopped talking.
Okay.
So, you know.
You are in the fourth ward, but you represent different neighborhoods.
Correct.
So
right.
You just want to clarify that. Your feelings about Mayor Virge Bernero are relevant here as well, since Jessica Yorko frequently supports the mayor in her votes. She's considered a member of his block on the city council, along with Tina Houghton and Kathy Dunbar. So the mayor's veto-proof majority could be jeopardized depending on the outcome of the fourth ward vote. Does that play a role in your considerations over who to vote for, Rena?
Not for me necessarily. I believe that some of the things the mayor I think that he does a great job in some areas, and other areas I have, you know, questions with, but he is our mayor. So that, you know, is what the issue is for some people. But for me, I just want the best person in. I want the person who's going to listen. I want the person who is going to answer phone calls and also attend meetings without excuses, because our city is hurting.
Can you, we're running short on time here, give us your assessment of the other of the three challengers here. We've got Chong Anacanfora, Bert Carrier Jr., an attorney, and Larry Hutchinson, a 40-year-old stay-at-home dad. Paul, are you plugged into the challengers?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have not met Larry Hutchinson. Who's the other gentleman, the lawyer you said?
Bert Carrier Jr.
I have not met him. Chong is my neighbor. She lives, I could walk over to her house, and she will open the door and invite me in for
sounds like accessibility.
Cup of coffee. Yeah, so she's very accessible. As far as the issues, I've been able to have a long sit down with Chung Anna, and I can be very candid in saying that I don't think she's out to do any harm. So,
okay. Rena, any comment on the challengers?
I think that, you know, we'll see about that later on, and like next week, I think that we all will see about that. It's been very interesting, to say the least.
Okay. Rena Risper is the president of the Walnut Neighborhood Association. Paul Johns is president of the Moores Park Neighborhood Association, both neighborhoods in Lansing's 4th Ward, and they've got four candidates up for city council in the primary next Tuesday. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
It's great being here. Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Early last month, it was revealed that the crime novel, The Cuckoo's Calling, was not written by Robert Galbraith, the name printed on the cover, but by J.K. Rowling, the mastermind of the Harry Potter series. While it was thought to be a publicity stunt to sell more books, it turns out that Rowling was considerably miffed. Just yesterday, it was reported that the best-selling English author accepted an apology and a substantial charitable donation from the law firm responsible for outing her. So now that we know who the mega-famous author is, just what is The Cuckoo's Calling all about? Current State book contributor Scott Southard offers this review.
Publishers, libraries, and bookstores like to pigeonhole writers into neat little boxes. Write one fantasy novel, and you wear that mantle for the rest of your career. Same goes for romance and science fiction and on and on. Some writers happily wear their personal albatross. Others fight it. J.K. Rowling is an author who fights it. Upon finishing her work on the Harry Potter series, the most successful literary creation of our lifetime, Rowling could have easily disappeared, hidden herself away like a Salinger. Instead, she came back with her first novel, The Casual Vacancy, which clearly and aggressively states, "I am not a young adult author." I pity the parent who picked up that book for their young reader, imagining another tale of Hogwarts. There are some rude awakenings there and some explaining to do. For her next novel, Rowling has shown herself to be even more rascally. For almost 5 months, she has been wearing a disguise, pretending to be a man named Robert Galbraith, a mystery detective writer inspired by his time in the British military police. And this Robert has created his first mystery novel, an impressive work entitled The Cuckoo's Calling. I've never understood the whole pseudonym road that so many writers go down. Many times it's done by an unknown writer protecting something I am uncertain of, giving their book really a second mountain to deal with in its possible rise to success. In today's congested book world, writers shouldn't give their book an additional obstacle. I also especially laugh when I see an author who happily explains in their Amazon description or on Twitter that they are using a pseudonym and what their real name is. So what? If the mystery can be broken so easily, why create it? Is this a tax loophole I was not aware of? The literary equivalent of the Cayman Islands and Swiss bank accounts? Robert Galbraith was created because Rowling wanted to see what people think of her writing without the burden of that boy wizard. Fair enough, I'll give her that one. But now the wizard has left Diagon Alley, and we are all in on the secret. So what is the book about? Lulu Landry is a supermodel who one winter evening apparently jumped from her apartment suite to her death. It was deemed a suicide by the cops and the papers. Months later, her brother, John Bristol, brings the case to Detective Cormoran Strike, convinced that her sister was actually murdered. Strike takes the case, not because he believes the brother, but that he needs the money. Who is Cormoran Strike? Every great literary detective has their own unique trademark. Miss Marple is old, Poirot is Belgian, Sherlock is, well, Sherlock, for example. But J.K. couldn't be happy with just one trademark for Cormoran Strike. No, she heaps things on to his description. Simply being the boy who lived is not enough. Strike is running a failing detective business. He is out of shape. He is missing a leg thanks to his time in Afghanistan. He is newly single. And did I mention he is the son of a famous rock star? If we as readers have a hard time putting our finger on what makes Strike strike, I can't imagine what the character must feel. So often today's mysteries can be confused with action adventures as heroes run from one location to another while bodies pile up. That is not how Strike works, and that is where I dig this character. See, what makes his book and Rowling's mystery writing stand out is that it's all about the dialogue. She is a master at this. Strike's talent is in listening and asking the right questions. He knows how to manipulate a conversation, not tricking the suspect, just getting exactly what he needs hidden in a paragraph. These interviews with the questionable individuals from Lulu's past, druggy hipsters, fashion designers, other models, lawyers, etc., are what makes this mystery shine. These conversations are meant to be read slowly, carefully, to be studied. Sadly, I am betting that it is these great moments that will be edited out when the inevitable movie is adapted. I'm sorry for Rowling that her secret is out. I'm sure she's disappointed as she was hoping to release another book next summer under the same pseudonym. But I would never have known about this well-written mystery if it wasn't for this publishing oops moment. Sometimes it is a good thing when the owl escapes from the bag. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott's the author of two new novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth in the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. The city of Lansing's first business incubator, the NEO Center, is marking a year and a half helping aspiring entrepreneurs launch small businesses. The NEO Center, short for New Enterprise Opportunity, offers office space and a variety of other resources to help these nascent endeavors get a foothold and hopefully take off. Tom Stewart is the founder of the NEO Center and a member of its board. He joins us today to bring us up to speed on activity there, along with Kate Tykocki-Snyder, a tenant of the NEO Center, who is also CEO of the brand new Piper and Gold public relations firm. Tom and Kate, nice to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good to have you back. Tom, are you where you thought you would be after a year and a half?
We are pretty darn close. I think a lot of times, so right now we laugh about, our board laughs about a little bit, you know, we're a startup helping startups still. And as we teach even the people that are our tenants, in your first 3 to 5 years of operation, there's usually some sort of major pivot or, you know, you're still discovering exactly how you're going to operate at your peak efficiency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after a year and a half, we're getting to that point where we've figured out a lot of things that work. We figured out a lot of things that don't work. And we're getting ready to make those adjustments and, keep moving forward.
So a healthy learning curve.
A healthy learning curve, absolutely.
How many tenants do you have room for, and how many do you have?
Well, we have room actually for 21 spaces. There are 21 individual spaces. Sometimes tenants take up more than that. Right now, we actually only have 8 tenants, and that's part of what we're trying to actually pivot towards. We actually want to move. Right now, we occupy the lower level and an upper level of the 3-story building, and what we're trying to do is move all of the tenants, the incubator tenants, up to the top floor to create more mass. some critical mass and get the tenants to interact with each other more often instead of having that split between two floors. And then find some anchor tenants for the lower level that are more service-oriented that can provide services to our tenants up on the first floor or maybe in that middle space. One of the things we talked about as businesses kind of graduate out of even the TIC here, the Technology Innovation Center in East Lansing, and maybe even graduate from our space, they're not always ready for that Class A space to go right from incubation to this huge office space in a multi-story building and
gotcha.
All that stuff. And so sometimes they need that in-between space, and you start creating this funnel for businesses to go through incubation and this middle ground and then continue on and up. And that's what we're trying to create, that same kind of funnel, even at Neo Center.
You want to create that middle ground,
correct.
Though. Is that right? Okay. Kate, I've been told you didn't plan necessarily on launching your own business, but fate intervened in a way. Tell us about your background with the Neo Center and about your business.
Yeah, I definitely feel like a very accidental entrepreneur. I spent about 8 years working in government and really loved being a public servant, but I was getting to the point where I felt like, okay, if I'm going to make a change in my life, if I want to try something different, now would be a good time to do that. And so I moved into the private sector, and it was really an awful fit, to be quite honest. And I ended up getting laid off and just kind of felt like, oh, goodness, now I need to go back to government or academia, something safe and stable where, you know, I know what to expect. And I kept meeting with, you know, references and people in town, you know, saying, oh, I'm in the job market now. If you know of anything, let me know. And they would say, okay, sure. But, hey, can you help me with this project? Or do you know how to do this? And so more and more, I just started saying, well, sure, I can help you with that. But really, I need my, you know, steady, stable, like senior level communications position in government. And after about 6 months, I looked around and I realized I have a full-time job. So I got a co-working membership at the Neo Center. I started off in the co-working space where you just kind of show up and you use the space, and it's a great way to get out of the house if you're, you know, a freelancer, independent contractor, and worked my way up to adding some team members in December. Had one go full-time in May of this year, and now we have office space in the Neo Center.
That's fantastic. Do you encounter a lot of accidental entrepreneurs, Tom, or is Kate the exception to the rule?
Well, Kate's one of our first accidental entrepreneurs, but we do, I mean, throughout our year and a half, we do encounter a handful of them. A lot of them actually start very similarly to that as far as taking on independent contracting work between jobs and then deciding they either like the freedom and they can get enough work that they're like, well, I should just do this full time, and I'm already kind of here working out of the Neo Center, so maybe I'll just take an office. We have another gentleman who did very similar, Michael Connor, and he's an occupational therapist who actually started co-working about the same time as Kate did, and he's moved from just doing co-working and having a couple of patients to having a full patient load, and now also having his own little cubicle office space workstation at Neo Center. So that's kind of the idea, you know, what we're trying to do in the long run anyway is help people be comfortable being entrepreneurs. So
if you could check one thing off your to-do list before the end of 2013, Tom, what would it be?
End of 2013, I think the biggest thing we want to do right now is actually start validating our programming. If I could start that process, actually, instead of finish it, would be a big accomplishment. Most of our programming and our curriculum is, you know, a product of years of me being in management consulting and then now board input and now industry experts giving their input to it. And now the next step for me is giving it probably to Michigan State University, like an MBA student or faculty, to start validating our programming and our questionnaires and stuff to really add value to it and say this is something we can license to other communities. We talk the long-term goal. Really, we want to standardize entrepreneur education across the state of Michigan. We've had inquiries from, you know, Shiawassee County and Traverse City, Cadillac, Flint.
What does that mean, standardized entrepreneurial education?
So incubators are becoming obviously really popular in the state of Michigan, and they've been around the nation for a long time, but they're on the rise. And what happens is not every incubator and every entrepreneur gets the same kind of access to resources. And sometimes that's education, sometimes that's mentorship. And a lot of times education coming out of the state or other quasi-governmental agencies is linear, meaning you come in, it's more like going to class, right? You have a 15-week course, you got to show up 2 nights a week. And entrepreneurs don't have time for that. They just don't. I mean, entrepreneurs want what they want when they want it. So we've tried to develop a curriculum that's much more modular and much more customizable so that we're assessing what entrepreneurs, their specific needs are and have kind of a set of resources given their needs.
Okay. But do you
and standardizing that?
But standardizing it from your perspective, you're not talking about public education, or are you?
No, I'm not talking about public education. That's
okay.
Correct.
Oh, okay. Kate, tell us about your specialties at Piper and Gold. What is there a pattern developing as to what you do well?
Yeah, so we are a traditional public relations boutique that has kind of a digital twist. One of the things in my career in communications that I was really fortunate to get to take the lead on is a lot of different social and digital media projects, but really focusing on being strategic about those and focusing on how you can bring that high-level thinking and really the management perspective into a lot of your tactics in PR. And so going out and, you know, helping organizations with this, naturally, we fit really well with government clients, association, higher education, and that kind of stuff, which Lansing is a great town to be in that business. But, you know, I know how to do PR, and I know how to do it well, but it's been really amazing to be in the NEO Center because I feel like I do have access to people that can answer questions for me about organizational development or, you know, about human resources questions, accounting questions, and the things that I've never had to do before in my mm-hmm. career. And I don't, you know, I don't personally have the experience in those things, and it's stuff you don't want to mess up when you're building a business. You know, you want to build that foundation really strong to begin with. And I feel you can't just base it on your services. We have to have great services we provide to our clients. But we also have to have a really smooth, well-run company. And it's been really invaluable for me to have access to the things that let me build that well-run company.
Tom Stewart, you're opening your doors tonight to the public to find out more about the NEO Center. Get to know NEO.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, basically, it's just an open house event, you know, similar to how residential do open houses. We just want to get people into our space, learn more about our organization, interact with our tenants, learn about what our tenants do.
Take a ride on the slide.
Take a ride on our two-story slide, absolutely. And then part of it, we did put together a special art project that I can't talk too much about. You have to come to the event to find out what that's all about. There'll be a short program at 6 p.m. The event's from 4:30 to 7:30. And then at 6 p.m., that short program will be unveiling the art project. And it's really cool.
And you're on Clark Street. In
correct. 934 Clark Street.
Yep. Is there a kind of business that a business incubator is not qualified to help launch? Could you help a manufacturer get started?
Yes, not specifically in our space. I mean, when you're talking about building widgets and whether you're making, you know, crafting a chair or building a gearbox, you know, those require some pretty heavy equipment. There is, you know, capital gains covered it, but there's a makerspace that's coming out, and they're kind of based out of the Temple building there right now. So absolutely, I mean, you can, and that's where these our education really comes into play, because our curriculum is based on the 9 core functions of business, which are it's a widely accepted. Those 9 core functions are widely accepted. But whether you're building a widget or providing public relations, those 9 core functions are always the same. So we could provide that education to a makerspace and then apply those 9 core functions just a little bit differently, tweak them just a little bit for people making widgets instead of a PR company.
Interesting. Tom Stewart is the founder of the NEO Center and a member of its board. And we also want to thank Kate Tykocki-Snyder, who's a tenant at the NEO Center and CEO of the brand-new Piper & Gold public relations firm. Their Get to Know NEO event starts at 4:30 this afternoon. Thanks, guys. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, too.
It's Current State on WKAR. Former State Representative Mark Meadows has been thinking about hiking the Appalachian Trail for decades. This summer, he did it. Well, about half of its 2,200 miles. Meadows started his south-to-north hike in Georgia in March, expecting warmer weather than the sub-freezing overnight lows he encountered during the first week. He stopped for the season after about 100 days in Maryland with his son by his side part of the time, and he hopes to complete the rest of the hike next year. Current state Scott Pohl took a walk with Mark Meadows on Lansing's River Trail to learn more about his Appalachian Trail adventure.
When you begin the trail, I think myself, like a lot of other people, sort of have a schedule. You know, you're going to do 8 miles this day from this point to the next shelter or something like that. But as you begin to hike, it's less important to have the target than the time. So you begin earlier, you know. I think the first night I was out, I got back on the trail about 10 a.m. and, you know, hiked till about 3 p.m. in the afternoon, did about 10 miles. And by the time I finished, you know, I'd do 20-mile days. It didn't matter, you know, if you made it to a shelter or not. You realize right away that you can just throw down your tent, or by then I was sleeping in a hammock, or put up your hammock anywhere. So you just hike till it starts to get dark, and then you settle down for the night.
You mentioned your son doing some of the walk with you. Was it otherwise a solitary endeavor?
I started out, I didn't have a partner or anything. I was going to do it no matter what, but honestly, you're never really solitary. I mean, you may be solitary in the sense that you're hiking during the daytime on a trail. They call it the Green Tunnel, although because I started so early, it wasn't so green when I began. You may not see anybody for hours at a time. On the other hand, every time you stop, you end up, you know, when I began, I'd end up with 30 to 40 people in the campsite at the same time I was. So there's a lot of people on the trail with this same objective, to finish hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Now, we decided to do this interview while taking a walk of our own, and we're on the Lansing River Trail. We happen to be on a pretty busy stretch of it right here. I'm going to guess you didn't hear a lot of automobile traffic like this.
No. We did cross roads every once in a while, but I can't say I heard a lot of automobile traffic at all. In fact, at some point, I think it was early June, was the 17-year explosion of cicadas along the trail. And really, it was as deafening as those cars were. It was just as deafening on the trail during the day. I mean, they are incredibly loud, especially when you have thousands and thousands of them that are hatching and up in the trees.
Was this a fitness thing for you, a scenery thing, some combination of factors like that led you to want to do this?
Yes, but I think that certainly the scenery is inspiring. And, you know, after you've climbed a couple of thousand feet, and then you're overlooking the broad valleys and vistas and the mountains rolling off into the distance, you say, you know, this is why I got up here, so I could see this. Because there's no other way to see that. But the actual physical challenge, I think, is the number one reason that I wanted to do it. I enjoy physical challenges, and to me, the idea of hiking, which I've always enjoyed, hiking, climbing, and descending, which actually is harder than the climbs, is something that you test yourself every day, and I wanted that test.
You sort of carry your life on your back, is that right? Essentially your tent, your hammock, your food. If you can't carry it, you don't have it, you don't use it, right?
That's exactly right. There's a freedom associated with hiking, period, but, you know, particularly on the trail, because for long stretches you won't be, you know, you can't just say, you know, I think I'll spend the night in town tonight. And so you have everything you need on your back, and you begin, as I did, I started out with, I think, a 36-pound pack. And the first four towns I reached, I sent stuff home. You know, it was stuff that you realize right away, I'm not going to use this. Or if I do need something like this, you know, the next town I hit, I'll just get it. You know, I told my wife, I think I spent like $1,000 on bandages while I was on the trail, because blisters aren't part of the trail, you know. And the it seems like I always had plenty of those in my pack.
Cold, hot, rainy, tired. Did you ever have moments of doubt? Why am I doing this? Did you ever find yourself trying to talk yourself out of it, trying to talk yourself into quitting?
No, I didn't talk myself into quitting, but I certainly had those questions sometimes. I remember I was walking into, or hiking into an area called Rock Gap, and it was probably 40 degrees. You know, it was pouring down rain. I was just soaked to the skin because what you learn very quickly is that, you know, your rain gear can be very good. It protects you from the rain. It keeps you from getting wet that way, but you sweat like a pig in that stuff. So you're always wet anyway. And so the, you know, I'm hiking down this trail. I'm thinking, what the heck am I doing? And that was after like a week before, when we were hiking in a, where the rain had frozen on the rocks. So it was extraordinarily slippery and dangerous for everybody who was on the trail. And so you do question yourself sometimes, but that whole experience is part of the physical challenge that and mental challenge that you have as you hike the trail. It makes the experience more valuable to you.
During the hike, you posted periodically to your Facebook page stories about what was going on around you, and very eloquently wrote at the end of your hike for this year about your experience, and actually expressed something akin to depression about stopping.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things you get used to, and I'm still adjusting to this, frankly, you know, that first week I got back, you know, I did a 50-mile bike, and then a 30-mile, and then another 30-mile, and did a hike through East Lansing, where I was out for probably a 10-miler, to keep my activity level a little bit high. And I've gone up north to our cabin, kayaked 10 miles, and hiked twice, 12 miles through the woods. The thing that sort of depressed me was that, what do you do when you become used to 8 to 10 hours of aerobic activity every day? I mean, I assume a lot of people think, you know, jogging, not walking, is an aerobic activity, but hiking is an aerobic activity that requires you to, you know, sometimes climb 3,000 feet. And during that time, it's an intense physical activity. Then you've got to come down that 3,000 feet, and sometimes that is so steep that it is just as strenuous and as an activity. And so when you get used to doing that every day, the idea of coming back and, you know, sort of searching for its equivalent, and you know you're not going to be able to find that, because, you know, you'd have to get up every morning and be out the door at 7 a.m. and just decide you're going to walk for 8 to 10 hours. And, you know, after a while that'd get kind of boring around here. I hate to say that, but you know, you can walk the river trail as we're doing, but, you know, after a while you don't want to just keep going over the same ground.
Well, sure, sure. So back next year, starting when?
You know, I haven't decided that yet. Originally, I was going to go north to south next year, and I've pretty much rethought that. I think I'm going back to my end point and starting north again. And the reason is that after a while you get what you call your hiking legs. You know, when I started I got to my first night, I put up my tent. I texted my wife and I said, man, it only took me like 5 hours to get to my point. I'm so excited. Can't wait till tomorrow. Well, tomorrow was the eye opener. That was much more of a climb and much more difficult than that first stretch that I was in. More like the real trail. From then on, you know, every day is this giant physical activity that, you know, you can't replicate anywhere else. If I go from where I started or where I ended, then I've got some pretty reasonable climbs through Pennsylvania and New York and into Massachusetts. And then the terrain becomes extremely difficult. The two most difficult areas of the trail are at the beginning and the end.
Well, Mark Meadows, I want to thank you for sharing the story of your hike on the Appalachian Trail. Thanks for indulging me in a walk along the Lansing River Trail and for taking it easy on a novice like me.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I was hiking the last 20 miles with a former colleague of mine who has served in the legislature with me, actually a couple of them, and one of them kept dragging behind. He's a big hiker. I mean, he's hiked all over the world. And he commented on how hard the trail was, but he also said, I'm calling you robo-hiker from now on, because I am pretty quick when I walk. So.
Well, Mark Meadows, thank you very much.
I'm glad to have been there. Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, along the Lansing River Trail, this is Scott Pohl.
Coming up Friday here on Current State, more conversation on next Tuesday's primary in the city of Lansing. Also, the World Dwarf Games kick off at MSU this weekend. Tomorrow, we will hear from athletes and from organizers as well. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.